This is the current federal tax developments for the week of July the 15th, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. Ed Zoller's coming to you again this week from Phoenix, where it's nice and warm. And we're going to look at a few things this week. It's been a big week for the beneficial ownership information reporting. We're going to talk about a couple of big developments there and one more S-corporation problem, shall we say. But we're first going to start out with the fact that FinCEN has just issued revisions to the frequently asked questions, going to end up adding three new questions and revising one answer. So we'll talk a little bit about that and how it works out. We also have what's probably one of the bigger things that happened this week was the New Jersey Committee on the Unauthorized Practice of Law released a letter outlining where CPAs, when CPAs and EAs can go ahead and prepare or file the beneficial ownership information reports under the Corporate Transparency Act for clients without necessarily needing the assistance of an attorney. That is, when it would not be considered the unauthorized practice of law for a CPA or EA to offer that service to their client. That's been a matter of concern, but so far we've had very, very little guidance on it. Now we actually have, again, it's only one state, but at least we have a state that gave us some guidance on how that's going to work. And then finally, we're looking at another private letter ruling comes out that is issued for S Corporation where it had trust as shareholders and the trustees missed their ESBT election date. In fact, in this case, it was two separate waves of changes that effectively should have required ESBT elections at the time, none of which got made. So we'll talk a little bit about that and why we continue to see this problem. Let's start out with the FAQ updates from FinCEN on beneficial ownership information reporting. Now, these updates came out on July the 8th. So that's the date you're looking. If you go to the FinCEN website, you'll find them there. You'll also find a brand new PDF. If you like downloading the PDF of the FAQs, there's a brand new PDF dated July 8th, which is how I track when they add something, because then it always shows up and you can go figure out what it is by looking for the entries that either were updated or added on July 8th. So it's easy to find. We're just looking for those inside that group. So as I said, they added three more Q&As to the website. And these deal with issues that relate to the January 1st, 2024 effective date. And also, therefore, whether filing is required, is a report required for an entity that's not otherwise exempt and would be required to file. For entities that were formed before the date the bill was enacted, which is back in 2001. Entities that cease to exist before January 1st, 2024, and a definition of what cease to exist means. And then finally, entities that were in existence during 2024 that cease to exist before their initial filing date and whether they have to file. So those, by the way, and especially that last one, is a big question that I think a lot of people had about, well, what if we terminate it? What if I accidentally form a, let's say we form an LLC, the client goes, gets started, and then decides, oh, you know, they went online, they formed it, then come back and finally talk with the attorney and us and decide, oh, I'm not going to use this thing and just go ahead and even go ahead and get it formally terminated. Do they still have to report? Probably not going to like the answer, but we'll talk about that answer when we get to that, what FinCEN said about that particular issue. We also got an updated answer to the question on Indian tribe-owned entities, fully or partially owned by an Indian tribe, and how that affects the reporting issues. So effectively, let's start out then with the first question, which is, this is question C-12. And in fact, you're going to find the three new ones are C-12, C-13, C-14. And this question asks, do beneficial ownership information reporting requirements apply to companies created or registered before the Corporate Transparency Act was enacted, which was back on January 1st of 2021? And, you know, the question is obvious. It's like, well, I didn't know these rules existed. We formed this entity. There was no such reporting rule. Like, for instance, here in Arizona, the only reporting is you have to report on initial formation about owners, but you don't need to report anything after that date. And I mean, you know, can they really force me to report things now when I thought I had put together an entity where it didn't need to be reported? Remembering that this is for law enforcement, I think you know your answer very quickly. Right? They're concerned people were forming these things in order to hide criminal activity. And that was the motivating factor behind why they pushed these through. So if that, if you believe that's happening, if you believe it's being used for, let's say, you know, child porn, it's being used to smuggle drugs, it's being used for all kinds of, you know, all kinds of wildly illegal activities, then yeah, you're not going to let them get out of it just because they came in early. And as you expect, that's what the answer comes down. Yes, it doesn't matter if you existed before January 1st of 2021. Beneficial ownership information reporting requirements apply to all companies that qualify as reporting companies, regardless of when they were created or registered. Companies not required to report beneficial ownership information to FinCEN if they are exempt or cease to exist as legal entities before January 1st, 2024. That's going to lead into later questions, but that's the key. So essentially, if you have an entity, whenever it was formed, if it's in existence on January 1st of 2024, or it comes into existence in 2024, right? Basically, it's going to have to file at least an initial report. So we're going to get to that. They're going to make that very, very clear in the later questions. Now, question 13, C13 asks, is a company required to report its beneficial ownership information to FinCEN if the company ceased to exist before reporting requirements went into effect on January 1st, 2024? So, you know, we formed this company back in 1967. It was terminated. This corporation was totally terminated, formally liquidated and cleared. Everything was cleared under state law in 1986. Do we somehow need to still go back and report that thing? And obviously, I think it makes sense, you know, what this answer is going to be. If the company is not in existence, it's not required to report its beneficial ownership information to FinCEN if it ceased to exist as a legal entity before January 1st, 2024. Now, the catch is what that means, and this is going to cause a little problem, I think, especially for those in Arizona. It's going to cause a problem because of a little cheat that has been going on here for many, many years to get around what was a rather messy, formal termination of corporation process. Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about that and why that's a potential issue. But what FinCEN says is the entity completed the process of formally and irrevocably dissolving. Now, we turn out they'll eventually back off of formally, but irrevocably dissolving will be an issue. Right, it's got to be that way. A company that ceased to exist as a legal entity before the beneficial ownership information reporting requirements became effective on January 1st of 24. That is the effective date. Please keep that in mind, not January 1st of 25. January 1st of 24 was the effective date of these rules. You just had a year if you were in existence on that date to get your initial report in, rather than 90 days or, you know, 30 days as the law would eventually will eventually get to, but you had a whole year. But that January 1st, 25 date is only a reporting date. Being around on January 1st of 2024 means that you got a report. You know, once we get to 2024, as soon as you come into existence, it's going to trigger a reporting requirement unless you can show that you meet an exemption. Okay? But that said, a company ceased to exist before that became effective, was never subject to the reporting requirements, and thus is not required to report its beneficial ownership information to FinCEN. Sounds great. Now, they talk here a little bit about how do you actually cease to exist? And it does note that state or tribal law may vary, but typically you complete the process of formally and irrevocably dissolving by, for example, filing dissolution paperwork with its jurisdiction of creation or registration. In Arizona, you would file that document with the Corporation Commission for a corporation, receiving written confirmation of dissolution. So they will tell you that, yes, you've completed the process. You pay any related taxes or fees. You cease to conduct business and you wind up your affairs, fully liquidating itself and closing all bank accounts. Now note, that's the entire process. If any of those remain undone as of January 1st, 2024, you are still a reporting entity. Right? You got to get all of those done by the 1st of 24. Not by the 1st of 25, by the 1st of 24. Keep that in mind. 24 is the effective date of the reporting rules. 25 is simply the due date to get that report to FinCEN that you ended up being required to file because you were there on January 1st of 24. That's kind of how you have to view this in this case. If a reporting company continues to exist as legal entity for any period of time on or after January 1st of 2024, it did not entirely complete the process of formally and irrevocably dissolving before January 1st of 24. Remember all of those steps in the last paragraph? If you hadn't totally completed all of that, then it's required to report its beneficial ownership information to FinCEN, even if the company had wound up its affairs and ceased conducting business before January 1st of 24. So remember that, even though maybe you've ceased, you haven't done it, but you haven't formally gotten all the paperwork run through the Secretary of State or Arizona Corporation Commission office, you're still a reporting entity. You've got to report. That's part of the key, at least per FinCEN. Again, this is their interpretation in the FAQs, so you can argue maybe it's at odds with the law, but I got news here. Most of my clients don't want to be the party to end up going to court and fighting that issue out to find out for sure if they overstepped their bounds. They might have, but again, litigating this probably isn't going to be worth the bother unless you just really love to litigate or you're a very bored attorney that doesn't have many clients and you just would love to just litigate on your own. Probably going to go broke if that's you, but still, if you want to do it, it's fine. Similarly, if a reporting entity or reporting company was created or registered on or after January 1st of 24 and subsequently ceased to exist, then it's required to report its beneficial ownership information to FinCEN, even if it ceased to exist before its initial beneficial ownership information report was due. Again, remember, you have to report because you existed in 24. The due date might be after you've dissolved, might be after you've fully liquidated, but yet things still got to report. And there is definite liability on the part of all the beneficial owners if that thing doesn't report. So be very aware of the problem there that you're going to have. Because again, penalties apply to everyone in this context. So you can't just say, hey, the entity doesn't exist anymore. What are they going to do? Where are they going to get the money? From you. That's basically the way it works. Because the problem will be you are never reported as a beneficial owner of this entity, even though you were by that time, which is your problem. For specifics on how to determine when a company ceases to exist as a legal entity, consult the law of the jurisdiction in which the company was created or registered. A company is administratively dissolved or suspended because, for example, it failed to pay a filing fee or comply with certain jurisdictional requirements, generally does not cease to exist as a legal entity unless the dissolution or suspension becomes permanent. You can't reverse it. Now, as I said, well known in Arizona that a lot of corporations have been dissolved over the years by going the administrative dissolution route. And by that I mean, you simply don't pay the $45 fee. Now, unlike in some states like California, where that's not going to really save you anything, they're going to keep piling up, you know, minimum tax fees forever until you formally liquidate the thing. In Arizona, you know, basically there's nothing really happens. If you have not paid the $45, to the Corporation Commission after a certain time, they will notify you of being administratively dissolved, at which point then you will need to, you know, either pay up and go in and get yourself formally reinstated, or, you know, you just ignore it. And so for years, a lot of people just ignored it. The problem is under Arizona law, and this will be true of a lot of states when you go this route, you just decide, I'm not going to spend time filing all the paperwork. We're just going to pretend the corporation doesn't exist anymore. And eventually the state will just let it go away. As I say, that's dangerous to do in California, but it's been normal activities in other states. The problem is that entity will continue to exist until that period where it can be resurrected ends. And for Arizona, that is 6 years from the day it's administratively dissolved. So it's going to take 6 years. Well, that will still be effectively a reporting entity. And as a reporting entity, you still got to worry about certain things like keeping up where the beneficial owners are and who they are, potentially if somebody dies, right? And, you know, that share is still held in there. Let's say for Arizona state, for estate planning purposes in Arizona, generally people who've seen the attorney are using revocable trusts for that purpose. So living trusts have become irrevocable at death. Well, those shares will just move to the trust. And it will have a new beneficial owner, likely, if not immediately, probably immediately because of the trustee, but shortly thereafter. I mean, there's a reporting event. Even if the entity is pre-2000 and has no, you know, pre-2000 has no activity, It would otherwise be a kind of, you know, an entity that's just not, you know, non-operating entity, non-existent entity, and it's prior to the date. It doesn't matter because you just had a change of ownership. And in theory, the penalties could apply. So yeah, you want to make sure in every state now you've got to tell people, no matter how much of a pain it is, if you don't want the BOI problem hanging over you for however many years it would take for an administrative dissolution to become irrevocable, you're going to need to formally dissolve the entity. That'll be your issue when we get there. Okay. Third question that was added, if a reporting company created or registered in 2024 or later winds up at affairs and ceases to exist before its initial report is due, is the company still required to submit that report? And you probably already guessed the answer by now. The answer is yes. It doesn't matter. Now, they already answered the last question. Technically, if you were in existence on January 1st of 2024, you basically have to file that initial report. They didn't actually talk about if that January 1st, 24 entity was, you know, ceased to exist by 25. But when you read the two questions, it's pretty clear if you're in existence on January 1st of 24, you're going to have to file. In fact, it's even relatively clear of this answer there, but we'll go ahead with this one. They're saying here, because this will apply going forward, it does not matter that I form an entity. Then I might actually talk with the attorney, talk with my CPA, and suddenly decide, hey, this entity makes no sense. We don't need this entity. We don't want to use it. So you go and terminate this LLC or corporation immediately. Nothing's ever been done with it. That thing's still going to file this report. Now, they do make clear that, in fact, you don't need to file, and this also is asked for. What happened when you cease to exist? Do we have to file a report saying we're gone? No. It talks about it in this context, but generally it's true. Nothing in the statute, nothing in the rules indicates, you know, the final rule indicates that there is any filing responsibility whatsoever once the entity has ceased legally to exist. They're never notified it doesn't exist anymore. So that may be an oversight of Congress. I may create some messes in the future, but nevertheless, there is no requirement to report the entity is gone, and there's no way to report the entity is gone. So it's just one of those things to understand at this point. Okay. Now, this was the Indian tribe question. This is just a revision on D-17. So if you've already read this question, I'm going to go through it very briefly because, you know, it's probably most of you do not have, you know, you have what's effectively a governmental-owned entity. Or partially governmental-owned entity. And to a large extent, the fact it's an Indian tribe instead of a state, city, county, whatever, not going to make a major change to these things. But apparently there was some questions, so they clarified it, right? They told you that if an entity fully or partially is owned by an Indian tribe, how is it reported as beneficial owners? Well, it talks about the nature of the entity owned by the tribe. This informs determination of whether the entity is a reporting company that must report beneficial ownership information. Remember, if it's not a reporting company, we don't care about beneficial owners. We have to keep that in mind. So it then reminds us that a reporting company must report its beneficial owners who directly or indirectly exercise substantial control of a reporting company and any individuals who directly or indirectly own or control at least 25% or more of the reporting company's ownership interests. So the tribe itself is not an individual. It should never be reported as an entity's beneficial owner, even if it exercises substantial control and owns or controls 25% or more of the entity's ownership interest. Entities in which the tribe have ownership interests may still have to report one or more individuals as beneficial owners in certain circumstances. But the tribe will never be, just like the city of Phoenix will never be, a beneficial owner, right? We don't care about entities. This is looking for individuals. You know, like I said all along, we're looking for people they can throw in jail. You can't throw in jail, you know, the tribal government, you can't throw in jail the city government or the state government. So we need people we can throw in jail, right? That's basically the point of this, is where we're looking. Now, if the entity is a tribal government authority itself, that's not a reporting company. It's a governmental authority. Governmental authorities are not reporting companies, right? This includes tribally chartered corporations and state chartered tribal entities if those corporations or entities exercise governmental authority on the tribe's behalf. Second category, entities' ownership interests are controlled or wholly owned by the tribal government authority. That would not otherwise be exempt because it could be an LLC or corporation, but if the tribe exercises full control, owns all interests, then they suggest you want to look at the fact that subsidiary reporting rules will exempt it because since the tribe is exempt and it's a wholly owned subsidiary of an exempt entity, then it's exempt, right? They talk about that wholly owned subsidiaries of exempts. And they have discussion questions there to explain that. So the one you're really going to be reporting on for the most part is when an entity is partially owned by a tribe and is not exempt. In that case, it's basically the same rules as always. If any individual other than the tribe, directly or indirectly, owns 25% of the entity, they will be a beneficial owner, and as well as people that exercise, you know, basically substantial control. And they explain that if they, in fact, own those interests through an exempt entity or a combination of exempt entities, then a reporting company can report the name of the exempt entity or entities in lieu of their individual beneficial owner information. That's question D12, as that information. So again, updates to the FAQs. I've warned you before, you've got to keep your eye on that site because they keep adding things to it, right? These are the most recent additions on July 8th. Okay. And they also remind you to go look at the small entity compliance guide and fine, that's there. Now, the next development is something that is unique. It's not just like they added a few more FAQs. On July 9th, there was a letter from Carol Johnston, Committee Secretary Counsel for the New Jersey Committee on the Unauthorized Practice of Law, which is appointed by the Supreme Court of the State of New Jersey, to Aisha Johnson, sorry about that, I clobbered her name, who's the CEO and Executive Director of the New Jersey, wrong state, Society of CPAs, right? This is from UPLC docket number 01-202. And this letter is a rarity. In most cases, we've had lots of discussion of the unauthorized practice of law, right? There's been all these discussions. Whenever we do BOI and I do a BOI course, we tend to end up talking about, is this the unauthorized practice of law? Is it not the unauthorized practice of law? Or is it somewhere in the middle? Okay. So, but we've had very, very little in terms of formal guidance. If you actually look at unauthorized practice of law issues in the various states, you're going to find that there normally are not a huge number of cases. There's very, very limited regulatory guidance of any sort that's out there. And, you know, it's just unclear. And to a certain extent, that unclarity helps. In the terms of the entities, the enforced entities, and to be honest, in terms of, you know, the idea of whether or not only an attorney can do something, you can argue that, you know, basically regulatory agencies become captive of basically those they regulate. That theory has been around for quite a while. And under that theory, of course, this kind of uncertainty makes it easier because nobody else knows, you know, what they can compete on. So discretion being the better part of valor, people just don't do those things is the theory about how it works. So not surprisingly, we have not seen a whole bunch of states come out with clear guidance about what is or isn't the practice of law when we're talking about the CTA BOI reports. And not also surprisingly, we had the insurance companies initially suggest they wouldn't cover anything if you did it. And suggest that it's just no way, sorry, it's, you know, and say magic letters UPL. That caused a big panic among CPAs and EAs. And I think, unfortunately, it's probably an unnecessary panic, not because there's not a UPL issue in here, because there is, but because we ignore the same UPL issue in a ton of other things that we're just used to doing. And that nobody cares about anymore because they've always done it in their practice. And even though there's no clear guidance that it's not UPL, they just kind of assume, you know, they just ignore it, right? We just go ahead and do it. So I find it a little bit interesting and amusing about, you know, all the concern this generated. I think the line is one that's not that difficult to work with. And it's a line you should be working with in topics outside of the BOI. But let's talk about this letter that was issued. So it's a formal letter from the formal committee. So it, you know, it carries some weight behind it, right? Now, the New Jersey Society of CPAs has asked whether CPAs could prepare and file BOI reports under the Corporate Transparency Act for clients? Can they offer that to the public? You know, it, or is that the unauthorized practice of law? Or is the answer somewhere in the middle? Hint, it's that last choice. Somewhere in the middle is what this committee decides. Okay. And while this only applies to the state of New Jersey, right? Remember, unauthorized practice of law is a state-level question, and every state has its own set of rules, regulations, and options that they can choose to enforce. I said quite often very unclear rules, regulations, and options, but still, it's there. So generally, you have to remember that your state may be different, and you need to keep track of updates that go there, you know, what you might hear about your state, if anything formal comes out like this for your state. But I will say that based on this and based on the fact that the conclusion arrives at, this letter arrives at, is the conclusion that I and others speaking on the topic have been suggesting is how this resolves itself in any event. I really believe you're going to find that when push comes to shove in the real world, this will only become an issue when you go over the line that this letter suggests you can't go over. And my take is you better not go over because you're going to be violating not only potentially the UPL statutes, but you may have some discussion with the State Board of Accountancy, even if there's no UPL charge against you, because you're going to have had inadequate technical competence to have taken on the engagement. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is actionable under virtually every State Board of Accountancy can haul you up and discipline you for that. So let's keep that in mind going forward. Okay. Now, the committee indicates, look, okay, we're going to consider, is this UPL? Or, you know, is this something that only attorneys should be able to do, you know, with the purview of it to represent the dangerous unauthorized practice of law by individuals who are not licensed counsel and not authorized to practice in the state of New Jersey? To determine this, the committee said, look, they're analyzing, looking at old case law in New Jersey, and which is very similar to what we've seen in other states. And they're going to say there are really two factors that you have to consider when you're making this call that they're going to be considering. First, they have to say, is the preparation or filing a BOR report the practice of law? Because if it's not the practice of law, it can't be the unauthorized practice of law, right? So it has to be a practice of law. But the mere fact it's a practice of law does not mean it's unauthorized. And that's something a lot of people miss. They seem to think if it's a practice of law, then, oh, no, I can't do it. No. As they said, if we determine it's a practice of law, the next question is it in the public interest to permit non-attorneys to prepare the forms, considering where the public needs to be protected from the activity of those who are not attorneys performing this service, or is in the public interest to not restrict this service to just attorneys? And that second question is the more interesting one of the two. And that's the one that I think we have to realize we're kind of always sitting on a little bit of that question. So we're going to look at this, right? So bottom line, the committee very quickly determines that the preparing and or filing of these reports is the practice of law in New Jersey, and I'd suggest in the states that have a reasonably clear definition of practice of law, it would probably be the practice of law in those states as well, including my home state of Arizona, right? Because because in order to fill this out, at least potentially, it would require you to apply the terms of a dense statute to a set of potentially complicated facts. Yeah, this can get wildly messy. I mean, there are all kinds of fact situations I could come up with that would be incredibly messy and would be very, very difficult to unwind. And sometimes there's just lack of clarity in the regulations themselves, the rules. Like, for instance, came up this week on a discussion forum was a question of, well, what if a company is right at the 20-employee limit, right, for the large company exception? So, you know, they regularly hire and get rid of people over time, and they're regularly either like at 19 or 21 employees. And that varies, right? And they may stay at 19 for a while, then they may go back to 21. You know, okay, so how do we handle that? Because whenever their employees are on whatever the count's supposed to work, you know, basically below 20, they are no longer exempt and they would need to have a recurrent report in. And that includes if they had been exempt and they dropped back under that limit, they have to file then a report saying, hey, we're back in here. We're reporting again. And similarly, if they go above that limit, they're also required to file a report saying, hey, we're exempt. So, you know, it's a real question. And what's not clear is we are told to use what's essentially the applicable large employer rules of the Affordable Care Act. But when you get into the FAQs for FinCEN, you discover that, well, you're not really using those rules. Well, you are and you aren't, because one of the key parts of those rules is there's an aggregation provision where you aggregate related employers. But FinCEN said, no. We don't aggregate for this purpose. We ignore aggregation, even though we do count aggregation for the revenue test, you know, the gross receipts test. We aggregate there, we don't aggregate here, which is weird, but okay, that's how it works. So the question becomes, how much of the other rules under the Affordable Care Act's ALE test for full-time employees, how many, you know, do we follow all the rest of the rules, or are we doing different ones? And I think a key one that comes up is, generally, you count employees on a month-by-month basis. Fine. But then what you do every year, because again, under the Affordable Care Act, we only care if you're in or out for this year, and under the Affordable Care Act, it's based on your average numbers of employees the prior year. So we just perform this test annually. Well, that could be an interpretation. We just do this once a year, so we'd only worry every year we'd rerun the test using 12 months under the standard calculation in those regs for 12 months, and then that's it. So we could only be swapped once every year based on this. And that is the only way to run the revenue test. They already tell you that for sure. But the flip side of it is, look, you do a monthly computation. So the question would come up, is in fact the 20 employee test conducted every month? So, because I can compute that instantly when the month is over, have access to the payroll records, I know what the hours are. You know, when I start looking at my people who have 130 or more hours, and count those up, that's my number of full-time employees under the safe harbor, which is probably the thing most people are going to use anyway. So then I know if I'm above or below 20 for the month. And again, full-time employees is tested on a monthly basis under these rules, so clearly we're not going to really test it under any shorter period. But is it monthly or is it annual? And I'm not sure I'm going to give you a clear answer for that one. That might be one where, in fact, you know, that's one where you might need legal training to try to discern, because this isn't the IRS issuing this rule. It's FinCEN borrowing the IRS rule, but then incorporating it into their own rule, which, you know, how's FinCEN going to interpret this and what are they going to do? So that's where it could be complicated. But again, there aren't many employers that are going to sit right on that number and keep going above and below constantly. Vast majority of employers are going to be well below 20. You're going to be below 20. We always know they're below it, like my accounting firm here. Or they're going to be well above it, and they know they're always well above it, like Walmart. Okay. So what they said was, the committee said, this is the end of the inquiry. You know, it's not just whether all such preparations, or is there, you know, do we need to protect the public in some way, shape, or form? And the answer is, you know, should be allowed to do this. And our key test is, you know, they note that, in fact, the majority of these reports are going to be not the complex ones, are not going to be super complex reports. That's important to understand. The vast majority of reports are going to be very, very simple and straightforward. So the point becomes, now there's not all these weird things to interpret. It's a single member LLC that has one owner who's the only person involved with this thing in any way, shape, or form. The committee says that is dirt simple. The only beneficial owner is that guy, right? And it doesn't take any severe legal training. It doesn't take huge amounts of legal training to figure that one out. You don't need to be an attorney to make that determination. So now we're going to take a look at that side of the equation, okay? Now, they go back and they look at some historic cases and rulings they've made. They start out with a 1986 case brought by the New Jersey Society of CPAs that raised the question of, could CPAs prepare and file New Jersey inheritance tax returns, right? New Jersey has an inheritance tax. They also used to have an estate tax. I think technically they still do, but it's 0% rate. It's a weird way to get out of the law without getting it out of the law, so you can restore it by just changing the rate. But they have an inheritance tax. You know, is preparing a New Jersey inheritance tax return the practice of law? And if it is, should it be restricted to attorneys? Now, I suspect most people listening to this broadcast would say, hey, nah, no, no, no. CPAs, EAs should be allowed to do that. That's a tax return. That's what we do, right? That's exactly what we do. Attorneys, get out of the room, right? It's not your thing. Well, or at least you'll fight a little bit over whether it's your thing. But, you know, it was a real case back in 1986. So in the case of INRI application of New Jersey Society of CPAs, which is a case cited there from 1986, we had basically the New Jersey Supreme Court decided if CPAs should be allowed to prepare these returns, or is that the unauthorized practice of law, UPL. Okay. Now, the court ruled again, this is the practice of law. It is applying, again, same basic test. It's applying a complex statute, interpreting it, providing legal advice, etc. And because of that, that would make it the practice of law. But they ended up ruling on much the same basis that, well, CPAs and EAs have training in the area. They have expertise. And to be frank, some of that expertise is expertise an attorney might not have, especially when we're dealing with entities, with accounting provisions, and, you know, various other valuation problems and things like that. Not really something in law school you're going to have tons of training on. So we need the other expertise to come in. CPA may not have direct training on it, but they're going to understand those concepts probably a bit better, but it's really tough to argue that business valuation is somehow the practice of law, right? It seems to be in a whole different category. So, maybe they're there. So what they decided was, well, it is practice of law because you have to decide, you know, an inheritance tax, usually you have different classes of beneficiaries, you know, and if you leave it to the right people, you don't pay any tax. You leave it to the wrong people, you pay tax. And you may have different categories of wrong. And if you're in the wrong category, you pay a really high tax rate. If you're in the not really that badly wrong category, you pay a lower tax rate, etc. And there may be interpretations of how things people fall into those categories or how certain property is subject to special rules or is taxed and what's considered part of the estate and what's considered part of the inheritance, taxable inheritance, and what's not. So what they said was that CPAs should be allowed to do this because, again, it's not obvious it's outside their expertise. It's not obvious that, you know, an attorney's expertise is absolutely necessary in every case to handle this. But the court said the CPAs do have to tell clients that a review of the return by an attorney would be advisable. And that point is, you know, that they're still saying it is a practice of law, and the client needs to make an informed choice to not make use of an attorney, right? So you need to at least tell them that an attorney could do this, and there are some areas of training that the attorney is going to have that are outside the background of the CPA or EA. Mine may or may not like that ruling, but you've got it, right? So, and the court said in doing this, they noted that any limitation on the practice of law must deal with the overlap professional disciplines. Reality is, we have a definition in every state of what's considered to be the practice of accounting. And certainly in Arizona, the practice of accounting would include, you know, things like preparing if we had an inheritance tax return, would include that sort of thing. That'd be part of the practice of accounting. And we have the Arizona State Board of Accounts, you have the Arizona Supreme Court, right? Who, you know, the Supreme Court's in charge of attorneys and the Arizona Board of Accounts is in charge of accountants. I mean, otherwise you may end up with this weird thing where if each one says you have to have our expertise to do this, then yeah, not gonna work. So, you know, we end up looking at that and kind of working with it. We see what we can do, right? And although it's not stated, arguably a number of BOI exemption rules involve the practice of accounting. Like gross income for large entities is definitely a practice of accounting rule, right? It makes a difference there. So that is a key factor when we look at this, how we end up working with it, how we end up handling it. So we need to understand that particular rule, right? That's going to be one of those key issues. And we could end up with no one being able to give advice absent consideration for that overlap. If we don't take that overlap into consideration, then we may end up with, well, you need to be a licensed attorney and a licensed CPA, and maybe a licensed business valuation person You know, and nobody has all of those, or at least maybe three people do. So it's a little different structure, right? Letter also refers to the committee's opinion granting non-attorneys limited right to draft corporate documents. UPL opinion 47 from 2011 was considered, right? And what they considered was, is there any demonstrable harm from allowing a non-attorney to perform this service? They had to take into consideration the cost savings to the public of not limiting it to just attorneys. They had to take into account that people were making the voluntary choice to use a non-attorney, you know, and they should have the right to make that choice. And finally, did the client understand the risk? And if all of that is true, you know, then they can figure out if it's okay for that to happen. And again, in this case, they ruled that, you know, as long as you told them, you know, they should consider having an attorney involved in the drafting, it's fine, right? Perform that, advise about the advisability of getting the assistance, but they could still be involved in performing that action. So to apply this to BOI, they decide the public does need some protection due to the fact that there are complexity of some matters under the Act. There are significant criminal and civil penalties involved, and the complex filings that require a lawyer's judgment, training, and expertise. There are some BOIs that only an attorney should touch. Okay. However, most BOI reporting situations are simply not complex, right? A knowledge of an attorney is not required to properly complete the form, right? They're very simple. It's obvious who the owners are. It's obvious who controls it. Not that difficult to figure out. In such cases, there would be a significant cost savings to the public by not requiring everybody to have an attorney assist them if they need any assistance, because a lot of people are just going to be not comfortable, right? They're going to want somebody to fill out a form. They're confused by it. So, you know, if you said they had to go an attorney, they're going to be paying a lot more money than arguably they need to, simply because we're going to restrict it to attorneys, right? They did say there's insufficient information yet determined if those entities, right, those doing BOI, who had to do BOIs by reports, are aware of the risk of using a non-lawyer, because we don't really know what those risks are yet. The Act is too new to really make determination about, you know, where are these nice bright lines to draw. And frankly, a lot may depend on how FinCEN decides to enforce this. So based on that, the committee concludes that a New Jersey licensed CPA or EA can engage in this conduct if the CPA or EA notifies the client it may be advisable to consult with a lawyer. And specifically, the committee relies on the professionalism of the CPA or EA, you know, to recognize when a filing is complex and is in the client's interest for an attorney to be retained. Now, that last point is simply required. It's not just required by the ruling. AICPA Code of Conduct, Ethics Section 0.300.060.04 requires a CPA to assess your competence and the firm's competence to perform the service in question and make a referral or obtain a consultation when the engagement exceeds the personal competence of a member or member's firm. And that particular ethics thing is there on the screen. Notice the underlined italicized portion. It establishes limitation of a member's capabilities by dictating that consultation or referral may be required when a professional engagement exceeds the personal competence of a member or a member's firm. Each member is responsible for assessing his or her own competence or of evaluating whether education, experience, and judgment are adequate, their own, for the responsibility to be assumed. You did not go to law school. There is going to be some issues here. You did not have training in, you know, weighing all the historical case law. You probably don't have the resources to look at all that case law, even if you had the competence to do it. So you need to refer a complex one out. Fairly clear, right? Compliance with this is required often either by direct reference to the Code of Conduct by the State Board of Accountancy Regulations, Arizona Accountancy Rule R4-1-455.A, and New Jersey NJAC 13:29-3.19, both incorporate the AICPA Code of Conduct, basically. Unless it's against state law, unless it goes against the state law itself or the rules of the board, it's considered to be binding on you. And sometimes, even in New Jersey, they have an explicit regulation that requires you to do the same, right? So that's there. This is in line with what carriers have been suggesting, what insurance carriers, what many have been suggesting all through this. Myself, Jim Hamill, who I heard lecture in New Mexico, made the same comment of, you know, the simple ones, the CPA probably should be doing. CPA or EA should be doing if the client themselves is not comfortable in doing it. But as you get to more complex ones, you really need to be referring this over to counsel. So simple BOI reports where the client wants assistance can be handled by the CPA or EA, but as CPA or EA, it's got to be aware of when the matter has strayed into legal analysis and may require the client to seek legal counsel. While we may not be legal experts, we should be able to recognize when this thing is something we're in over our head on. So that's going to be key, right? It's also to be sure anybody in taxes document that you've informed clients of the need to do this. Because especially now with what FinCEN said about CPAs and EAs helping clients do this, what this letter is now saying and where the insurance carriers are going, you could be in trouble for not having informed a client about these rules. So be there. And remember, the real problem is not the legal issue for practice of law. It's trying to figure out how to get the clients to notify us or the attorney or whoever when there has been a change in situation that requires an updated report. Finally, we have the last of the PLRs, another case where an S corporation advisors appeared to have been asleep at the wheel regarding trust being S corporate. It's a private letter ruling 2024-28001 issued on July 12. The IRS continues to be extremely forgiving when people blow ESBT elections, which is okay, but they always collect the private letter ruling fee when this happens, so be aware of that. In this case, we have a trust holding shares that went through two separate major changes, right? Presumably professional advice, but somehow missed the elections both times, okay, and had to ask for relief. Originally, the trust involved was 100% grantor trust. That is, eligible to be an S corporation, no elections needed, nothing fancy. However, somewhere down the line, the trust was revised to no longer meet the requirement, intentionally revised to no longer be a grantor trust. And it had provisions in it that would allow the trust to be an electing small business trust. Fine, so it was eligible to make the election, but the election was never made by the trustee. Okay. But it gets worse. So the S election is already terminated here, but let's keep going. Further down the line, the trust was then subdivided under terms of the trust into four separate shares, creating separate share subtrust under IRC section 663C. Again, these separate shares met the requirements to be treated as an ESBT. But again, since they're considered effectively four trusts, we need new elections. We didn't have any to begin with, so I guess maybe we won't say new. We just need an election. Again, though, none of the trustees made the election, so the election was not made. So even if the election hadn't been terminated, it would be terminated now. Eventually, the S Corporation noticed the problem. Probably often it's due to a due diligence review when the pros sale to a larger entity where they want this fixed. And the corporation files for a PLR to retroactively restore S status, paying legal fees probably and fees to the IRS for, you know, the letter ruling user fee. The IRS agreed these terminations were inadvertent. They agreed to restore the S status, continue on the ESB elections being timely filed by the deadline in the letter. And so you get out of it, but you pay quite a bit. Clearly, there's a big problem in this area because these rulings keep on coming and the situations are just getting worse. They're getting wilder. If you are involved in trust or estate work, make sure you understand the QSST and ESBT election rules, right? If you're near this and it screws up, you're going to be one of the people called in for liability for paying for all that work. Make sure you read the documents to determine if it appears that such an election was contemplated by the drafter of the documents. Make sure you explicitly tell the attorney, you may have an attorney who's simply an estate expert and it never works with S corporates. I actually had an attorney a few years ago told me that. She said, I don't do S stuff. You tell me that we're doing okay, do the S stuff at this point, right? It's not my area. Okay, fine. So we of course were talking to her about the S side of the equation to make sure that we didn't blow the S election. So make sure you understand that. Similarly, if you handle S corporation clients, be sure to inquire about whether any share has been transferred to a trust. A client might not tell you that. Even if it goes to a grantor trust, remember that thing, if the trust has changed, will become non-grantor and we will have a problem, as in this case, right? Make sure you document why the trust is an eligible shareholder. It's the legal owner of it. Why is it eligible to be an S shareholder? And remind the corporation of any required elections by trust shareholders if we ever get, you know, a trust in there. It's important we know if there's a trust that's become a shareholder, even if that trust is revocable, right? And counsel that drafts the estate plan should contemplate having S shares move into trust really need to clearly inform all parties, including people that will be alive when this shareholder dies, about the implications of the estate plan and the fact that there is, we're expecting it to make an ESBT or expecting the beneficiary to make a QSST election. Please make sure they're aware of that, because it's very obvious we have these documents perfectly drafted to handle this stuff, and nobody ever seemed to know it had to. That's a problem. This has been, therefore, the current federal tax developments for the week of July 15th, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your State Society of CPAs. Again, we will be back here next week to keep you up. If you have any questions, you can email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also find me on the Connect sites for Arizona, New Jersey, Idaho, Illinois, Minnesota, societies of CPAs. And we'll see what else comes up this week. But anyway, you have a little bit of BOI stuff to chew on for this week, and we'll see you back next week for current federal tax developments.